Welcome back to another episode of Rebuilding the Palisades podcast, hosted by DSI. I'm Zach Fagan, and today we have the illustrious Kevin Orrick. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Well, let's get right into it. Okay. Tell me a little bit about how you initially got interested in architecture and got started with your own practice.
I definitely did not take a direct route to architecture. My undergraduate degree is in cellular biology. Yeah. And I guess the best way to explain that is when I was a kid, I saw myself either as a mad scientist, emphasis on the mad, that was important, or an artist. And by the time I got to high school, I had sort of refined that choice to biology or architecture. Architecture seeming like, in a simple-minded way, art with a little bit of science thrown in. And when I went to college, I still wasn't sure what I wanted to do, and so I reasoned it would be a lot easier to pursue the science and possibly switch to architecture than it would be to do the reverse. And so that's exactly what I did. I got my degree in cellular biology, decided I wanted to be an architect. I didn't want to be in science. And I took a year off and traveled and applied to architecture school. And I was lucky that UCLA likes to accept people from different backgrounds. So I was accepted to the master's program at UCLA in architecture with a portfolio of paintings and virtually no architectural education.
Wow.
So I became an architect, and that's what I've been ever since.
Wow, very cool. Very cool. And how about your, I don't say decision, but working for yourself in your own practice as opposed to working at a firm?
People going into architecture, I think, can roughly be broken into two camps. There are the people who like to be part of a big firm and maybe play a smaller role in large projects. And then there are people like myself who prefer to be in a part of a small firm and play a larger role in smaller projects. And that's what I did in my apprenticeship. I apprenticed for a one-man architecture firm. He was an older man with a huge amount of experience, great knowledge in all the various aspects of architecture. I did my three-year apprenticeship for him and went out on my own and have been a firm mostly of two. I've had one employee. Now it's just me. At one point I had two employees. I didn't like it. I felt like I was managing all the time, not designing. So it's really a personal choice. You know, there's less projects that I can't take on as many projects when it's just me. But on the other hand, there's a great efficiency to it being all me. And I think it really benefits my clients because they're not going through layers of staff to get to me. I'm at every meeting. I mean, because otherwise there'd be no one there. And so I really like that hands-on approach.
Yeah, gotcha. So the degree in cellular biology, mm-hmm. The eventual shift to architecture. Mm-hmm. Is there something about, you know, is it the design process or the problem-solving process of architecture that really drew you? Or was there something in the science field that kind of repelled you? What, like, how did it kind of, like, was there a catalyst somewhere where you're like, you know what, architecture is really, that's really where I want to go with this?
Yeah, it was definitely more the attraction of architecture rather than the repulsion from science. I loved science. I worked and spent a couple summers working in biochemistry labs and loved it, but I didn't feel like that's what I wanted to spend the rest of my life doing. And what really appealed to me about architecture is I could even see it in the education. When I was studying science at Berkeley, I had to kind of rationalize taking any course that wasn't directly applicable to what I was studying. I took art classes and that sort of thing, but it wasn't what you were expected to do. Whereas for architecture, virtually everything is relevant. You know, because it's so much a part of our culture. You can take a history class, a science class, whatever, and it's going to be relevant to architecture. Mm. And I do feel like that science background has really helped me in a lot of ways as an architect, because there's a lot of technology in construction. And though other people are primarily the ones doing it, the structural engineer, maybe a mechanical engineer, people like you guys with, you know, low voltage and that sort of thing, it still really behooves an architect to have enough of an understanding of those things that their design isn't in conflict with those things, but rather works in harmony with them. Mm. So I do feel like I've been, I don't feel like it was a waste of time that I spent 4 years studying something else. I think it really helps me.
For sure. Well, great segue. That's kind of my next question is, you know, does your science background really influence, you know, your work in architecture? And I think the answer is yes.
It does. Yeah.
For sure. Yeah. Very cool. Very cool. So, you know, you founded your own firm in 1990. You've deliberately kept it small over mm-hmm. the years. It's kind of gone back and forth from a few employees, you know, back and forth. But, you know, you've chosen to, you know, kind of maintain, you know, a boutique practice. How does having a smaller team or just being a smaller team or a one-man show kind of shape your approach to projects?
Well, I feel first and foremost that I'm very invested in every aspect of the project, because I can't say, oh, that's so-and-so's area. It has to be right, and I have to take responsibility for that. Even if I'm a one-person firm, there's always a team that's building a project, and I like to be really hands-on and part of that team, but there's the contractor, the engineer, etc. So it is still a team process. It's just that the architecture part of it, I'm kind of greedy. I want to do that part. I want to do it all myself. Mm. So I think the net result of that is I'm familiar with everything because I did it all from the architectural point of view. So I feel like I can take responsibility for the project and, you know, really understand it.
Yeah, you're accountable to all of the different aspects of the project, and no matter what the question might be and who that stakeholder might be asking the question, you'll know the answer.
Right.
Right, because you're that intimately involved with the project. Well, that's a really unique way of approaching things, and there's value there, right, for your clients.
I think so.
You know, without doubt. So, you know, you're a member of the LA Conservancy and the Society of Architectural Historians. You've restored some historic homes. You know, they're built by, you know, noted architects like Paul Williams. How does your appreciation for architectural history play in to your work and to your approach?
I think it's very fundamental to it. I think that if I were going to say one thing about my philosophy of working, it's having respect for, if it's a remodel, respect for the existing building, unless it's just an irredeemable, terrible building. And those do come along and they can be very freeing to work on. But Los Angeles has pretty shamefully torn down so much of its historical past that I think it's really important to keep what's left. And that doesn't just mean individual landmark buildings by famous architects. It's also the fabric. And my goal has always been to either remodel, or if it's a new house, build a new house so that it fits comfortably in that fabric and feels like it belongs there. That someone seeing it would think, oh, that's a great house. It looks like it was built when these other ones were. Or, you know, it belongs in that particular place. An interesting thing about Los Angeles is it's a hodgepodge by design. It always has been. You'll have an English Tudor house next to a Spanish style, next to a Craftsman. And that's the way it is. That's not something that we should try and correct. That is Los Angeles. And so I have respect for that. My work ranges from different historical styles to modern. I mean, in a vacuum, modern is my preferred style, especially, I always use the word modern rather than contemporary, because I think contemporary has veered into a more sterile form. I think modern, as we saw in the case study program and with mid-century architecture, is one of the high points of residential architecture. The way that it supported comfortably a life for the occupants, for families, without, you know, I always think of contemporary architecture as something that you ruin by throwing the car keys down onto a table. You know, that's not what I want to do. I want houses that people can occupy comfortably. But I think modern design is fantastic. So, yeah. But if I'm hired to remodel a Spanish house, or in the case of one of the houses in the Palisades that I'm working on, my client's previous house was Spanish. It wasn't a great one, but they really liked the Spanish style, and we're building a new Spanish house for them. It's a better example of a Spanish house, but that's the style they want, so that's the style I'm doing for them.
Yeah, right on. Everyone's different. Everyone has their, you know, opinions and, you know, thoughts on, you know, what's good and what's not good, right?
Discover why we're the most awarded home technology firm in the U.S. Our design-centric approach transforms your space with effortless control of lighting, motorized shades, audio, video, and more. Our friendly experts guide you every step of the way. No tech speak, just smart, stunning simplicity. We provide years of care from our award-winning service and support team. Experience technology that feels as good as it looks.
So obviously there's, you know, some tension in the architectural space to the extent that, you know, kind of the way that you described it, right? And having a craftsman next to a tutor, next to, you know, whatever. So, you know, talk a little bit about that tension, as it were, in LA, right? Just with regard to kind of the modern designs and the more classical architecture, and you know how do you deal with that tension in the neighborhoods, and if it really exists at all? I mean, do you see it as tension even?
I don't see, if a particular neighborhood has that kind of mix, which many in LA do, I don't really see that as a tension. What would be more of a tension is if you had a neighborhood, say the around Carthay Circle. I don't know if you're familiar with that neighborhood. There was a developer, I believe in the 30s, named Spiro Ponti, who built many sort of deco-inflected Spanish houses. And so the fabric of that neighborhood are those Spanish houses. It wouldn't be appropriate to come in and plop a Tudor down in the middle of it. That would be a tension that I would want to avoid. But if a neighborhood just sort of organically ended up with all those different styles, that is the fabric. The bigger tension, I think, is where you draw the line between what you really need to preserve and what you need to do to accommodate a modern lifestyle. You don't want to make unless you're working on something is like a historic monument, and then I'm a docent at the Gamble House. You do not make changes to that house. Right. Everything is researched. Everything is done. You know, if you have to do work on it, it's done completely faithfully to the original design. But, you know, most houses, like if I'm remodeling a house in Hancock Park that's of Spanish style, you're not going to put in a 1930s refrigerator in the kitchen. You know, there have to be concessions to modern life. And there isn't a clear answer on that. I draw the line at, my clients often make fun of me for my aversion to recessed lighting in old houses like that. I really generally object to it. That's a line that I don't like to cross. But we have modern appliances, so there's not really a right or wrong. It's a judgment call. And I think that tension can lead to really interesting design. You see it a lot in parts of the world where they're more comfortable with their history because there's a lot of it, like in Europe or even New York compared to Los Angeles. People will have pristine shell of the building, but then do very modern, you know, fixtures and hardware. And that can be better than, you know, either all new or all old. It reflects the fact that time has passed and we're occupying a moment in it.
Sure. While still respecting the past.
That's the important thing.
Yeah. Yeah, no, interesting. So, you know, shifting gears a little bit, you know, when do you think, you know, like as far as designing in, you know, designing a home in a fire-prone area, like what considerations come into play for you?
So one thing that's good, a little bit of a, I hate to say silver lining, but a benefit of this horrible tragedy that's happened in the Palisades and Altadena, is that just rebuilding these homes to the current code will make them much more fire resistant than they were. Yeah. There are rules if you're in what is called the very high fire severity zone, which I think they've renamed it subtly differently, but I forget what that is. But anyway, in that zone, there's all kinds of things you're required to do. You don't sheathe the home with combustible materials. You don't put attic vents under the eaves. The eaves need to be non-combustible. The glass and windows needs to be tempered. Wood shingles, fortunately, went away a long time ago. That was, you know, a huge positive change. All those things make a big difference. Some further things that I've been looking at, and I've done a lot of research in the last few months about this, I've come to the conclusion that nobody in a fire zone should have a ventilated attic. The code requires you to ventilate attics. It's a way of dissipating moisture and heat. But there are conditions where you can get away with not ventilating an attic. The reason that I think no one should have ventilated attics is I think a lot of houses burned down because embers got in through those vents and ignited the attic.
Exactly.
It's a, you know, it's a chink in the armor of your house. And I've watched a whole bunch of YouTubes on, you know, different ways of not ventilating your attic. In other parts of the country, they think it's kind of crazy to ventilate an attic where you have all your heating and air conditioning equipment, because basically that equipment's sitting in, you know, maybe 20 below weather in the winter and very hot weather in the summer. Here we don't get the 20 below, but we definitely get the heat, and that's a big strain on your equipment. So if you can seal up the attic, you make it more fireproof, you make it more energy efficient, but you have to be really careful about moisture. I don't know how much you want to go in the weeds on this, but there is special insulation you can use called closed cell spray insulation. If you use that insulation and you deal with moisture, either by conditioning the attic or installing a dehumidifier, you can forego all that attic ventilation. So I'm doing that on all the projects I'm doing in the fire area. Another thing I'm doing is building on concrete slab as opposed to having a raised floor foundation, because that seems like another area that an ember can get into. Mm-hmm. And your floor is made of wood in that condition, so it's something else that can burn.
Right.
So that's two things in addition to all the requirements of the code that we're doing to be more fire resistant. Landscape will play a big role. You know, you want a defensible zone around the house. One house that I'm doing now in the Palisades is one that I designed 20 years ago. It was a remodel at the time, and it had a metal roof and it had fiber cement, a non-combustible form of siding on it. And when my client called me after the fire, he said, "We had a metal roof and we had non-combustible siding and the house still burned down. Why?" I'm convinced it was the attic vents, but that house wasn't even considered at risk for fire back when we did it. They've now expanded the fire zone to include probably all of the Palisades, but definitely that neighborhood. Yeah. Another thing, though, that I've run across in my research, if you have a metal roof, though metal is non-combustible, and that's a good thing, it also conducts heat very effectively. So if you have a raging fire going on, that heat can ignite the plywood or other materials under the metal roof. So I'm now calling out a material called Densdeck, which is like half inch to three quarters thick, and it is supposed to prevent that heat from transmitting through. So little things like that.
Sure.
You know, and we're kind of figuring it out as we go.
Yeah. Well, I'm familiar with that closed cell spray and insulation. I saw it for the first time on the East Coast, New England. And I remember being at the house and the client said, oh yeah, some Lutron panels, you know, they're for this area of the house. They're up in the attic. I'm like, oh great. Here, I got to go in the attic, you know, and pull down these real nice attic stairs and the light automatically comes on. And immediately I see that the eaves are sprayed in. I'm like, oh, what's that? You know, not fluffy insulation. And as I get up in there and I see that not only is it all spray foam insulation everywhere, like a giant igloo cooler, but it's fully decked with proper plywood everywhere. And it's like neatly done, neatly lit. It's like I'm almost like conditioned space. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't super hot in there because, you know, the insulation is like 8 or 12 inches thick on these giant beams. So I know it's more expensive to do that, but it really lasts forever, and it's really amazing insulation with killer R value and all that. Are you specifying that insulation on the new builds in the Palisades?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes. You are. Great. Okay.
You can't really get away. It's so fire is scary. Mold is also scary. Mm-hmm. And what can happen with conventional insulation... So normally what you traditionally do is you put the insulation in the ceiling and the attic was part of the outside world. So it would be cold when it's cold outside, hot when it's hot outside. What you're doing now is insulating the roof and bringing the attic into the fold of the house itself. But with regular insulation, we generate moisture as, you know, biological beings and cooking and bathing and all that, that moisture will rise up into the attic. And if it rises up into conventional, say, fiberglass insulation, and then it encounters a cold surface on the underside of the roof or the cold surface on your air conditioning ducts, you'll get condensation and you'll get mold. The thing about that closed cell insulation is it doesn't allow moisture in, so you never have the encounter of that warm, moist air and a cold surface. Mm. That's why you can get away with that. So I would never do an unventilated attic without using that insulation.
Gotcha. So caveats there if you're going to use the insulation.
Yeah, it's something to check out. I did a lot of research before I made this change. And then I upped my professional liability insurance just in case.
Just in case. There you go. Let me ask you a little bit about, you know, just a beautiful home, right? How do architects continue to design, you know, beautiful homes that are also, you know, fire resilient, right? That are made up of the materials that we already know are fire resistant or hardened materials, as some of them are called, you know, continue to use what we know about and continue to add to that product mix any other new product that may come along that's also, you know, a resilient product, and continue, you know, to build things that buildings that are pretty to look at, right?
Right. You know, I think some of that depends on the style. Spanish, for example, is one of the easier styles to fire harden because stucco and tile roofs and all that are what I so the. Spanish house that I'm working on now in the Palisades. Sometimes Spanish houses have wood rafters, rafter tails supporting the roof. I'm not doing any of those. Instead, there's a stucco detail just under the roof edge. Mm. So there's no vents. There's no wood on the exterior. The windows are clad with aluminum. The glass is all tempered. So that's a pretty fire-resistant house. The other one is... I would call it the one that I did 20 years ago and we're rebuilding now was a Cape Cod style. That also is not too hard to fire harden because all the woodwork is painted and you can use fiber cement siding. And, you know, as long as it's painted, it looks just like wood. I've been using that for a long time anyway, because the climate of Los Angeles is not friendly to wood on the exterior of your building. The one thing that we had to change was originally that house had open eaves. You saw the little rafter tails sticking out, and there was no fascia board on the end. And that was a really nice look, but it's hard to make rafter tails non-combustible. So now what we're doing is we're wrapping that in fiber cement So it's a little bit of a different look, but it's not a compromise of the aesthetics of the house. If you had a craftsman house, that would be much more difficult because that's all wood.
For sure.
You can fiber cement some of that stuff, but often the wood is stained and fiber cement doesn't stain. So that would be tougher.
Sure.
You'd probably have to make some difficult choices.
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. Understood. So, you know, beyond the physical structures, how do you see architects and architecture kind of helping to heal, you know, and rebuild, you know, the spirit, you know, after a disaster like this?
Well, I think for both the Palisades and Altadena, the healing is going to come when people have houses again. That's the first thing. But the other thing is, I think it's really important that those neighborhoods don't lose the character that they had. That's especially true in Altadena, but also in the Palisades. A lot of people think of the Palisades as all, you know, very wealthy contemporary homes, but there were modest neighborhoods. It was smaller. One of the houses that I'm doing is 2,400 square feet. That's not a McMansion. I would hate to see all those 2,400 square foot houses be replaced with 5,000 square foot houses. And what I think the city has done, which is smart, one of the executive orders that came out almost immediately after the fires was they have conditions which can make you eligible for what they call an eligible rebuild. For example, if you, it's a little vague, but the, as someone described to me, they're building the plane as they're flying it. If you did not increase the, at first they used the word bulk of the house and the height by more than 10%, you would get an expedited permitting process. You would be exempt from Coastal Commission, which if you're in a neighborhood, you know, an area that is subject to Coastal Commission, that can take forever.
Yeah.
You could even keep, if say your house is too close to the property line by today's standards, but it was to code back when it was built, you can build it back to those lines. And there are some other advantages as well, but those are huge bonuses. Mm-hmm. But what they're doing is incentivizing you to not mansionize, to keep, you know, make the house a little bigger, but 10% is not a lot.
Right.
That house that I referred to as a Cape Cod, that house was 3 feet from the property line on one side. If we went to the current standard, which for that house would be, because of the height, would be 6 feet, the house gets squeezed in a really difficult way to deal with. So we took advantage of that. We're making basically the same house, except for those upgrades for fire resistance and also upgrades for the fact that, you know, they had young kids when I did the house for them originally, and they're now grown and moved out. We're kind of expanding the house all on the inside. I've changed the construction of the floor and between the floors to get them another foot and a half of ceiling height on the two floors without making the building taller at all. And other things, you know, the relationship of the kitchen to the rest of the house is going to be better for their lifestyle than it was. So, yeah, those are some of the things we've been doing.
No, that's great. I hadn't heard the term eligible.
Eligible rebuild.
Eligible rebuild. I have heard the 10% number being thrown around, that you could expand by, you know, an extra 10%, and that wouldn't, you know, cause any kind of disruption or delay, you know, in permitting. But I didn't realize that there was an exception also for setbacks because, you know, I have a little house up north and it's part of it is built on the property line.
Right.
And I realized that the little bit of work that I wanted to do on this kind of like, it's kind of like an outdoor kitchen, bathroom, kind of like pool house kind of thing, you know, structure that was there. Any work I wanted to do on that, I'm immediately going to lose at least 3 feet, you know, because I'm going to have to adhere to today's setback, right? So 3 feet's gone. It's like, well, there's my barbecue. There's half my cabinets. You know, there goes the shower too. It's like, okay, now what? You know, I have to go up and it's just, so that kind of concession is probably critical in some cases, the one you just described. You know,
That project I was talking about, the garage is right on the property line, which used to be legal and it no longer is. Moving that garage 5 feet in would really adversely affect their backyard. The driveway would have to jog.
Right.
So it's a great thing, but it's been not a totally clear process. So as I said, they originally just said keeping the bulk within 10%. Well, that's a very vague term. Now what they said was, all right, the first floor footprint cannot increase by 10%. Okay, that seems pretty clear. I found out yesterday on a project I'm working on where our front yard is much less than it would be by today's standards. This is interesting. The front yard setback is generally a prevailing setback. It's roughly an average of the houses on your side of the block. Because all the houses burned down, the prevailing setback is defaulting to 25 feet. Whereas none of the houses were that far from the property line before. So the whole neighborhood's getting penalized for that unless they get this eligible rebuild categorization. So we would have to lose 8 feet of backyard if we didn't comply with the 10%. But here's what I found out yesterday that I still haven't figured out how we're going to deal with this. They take the footprint of the existing house and you superimpose the footprint of the new house. What we were doing was coming in further from the side property lines to conform to current code, even though they weren't making us do it, because fire jumps house to house. I think it makes it safer by maintaining more distance. It's one of the reasons for that code. And then we were adding bulk back onto the back of the house. Well, I just found out yesterday that they're not crediting you for places where you're reducing the footprint. They're only dinging you for the parts where you're adding to the footprint. And all of a sudden, we're like 800 square feet over the limit. And I don't know how I'm gonna spend a day trying to figure that out.
Yeah. Well, this is,
and that could change again.
Absolutely. I was just going to say this. There are always, it seems like, more rabbit holes, right? And just when you think you got it going on, you realize, there's another one.
Yep.
I don't envy the position that you're in and dealing with some of the navigating through some of this. And of course, anyone watching the show, you know, who's a homeowner, is a lot of homeowners are probably feeling overwhelmed.
Yeah.
Not to, you know, to say anything of the trauma they've already dealt with, but now being faced with complex challenges as it relates to conforming or not conforming to the latest or qualifying for this, being eligible for that. It takes a professional who knows what he or she is doing just to navigate this. And you're a great example of a professional who's been doing this for a very long time, who's found himself scratching his head going, what are we going to do here? So, you know, that's part of why we're doing this, is to get all of the voices that we can kind of at the table and, you know, let's have a conversation about what resources are available. What can other design build professionals and homeowners, you know, do? What resources can they access to figure this stuff out? And just to highlight, like, hey, city of LA, right? Like, this is a problem.
Yeah.
We need people to think about these things. And these are real projects, real people, real projects that have real needs right now. This is where the focus needs to be on, you know, changing and updating the code and deciding who's going to get, you know, we're going to give you a pass and we're going to give you a pass. And, you know, it's complicated. So, you know, it's always good to get, you know, just a little bit more knowledge. Every day I learn a little bit of something new. And if I can pass any of that knowledge on to anyone else in the industry, then that's, doing a little bit of my part as it relates to spreading good info. So, I mean, have you worked on any projects that have brought people together? Like, have any of the jobs that you've worked on or been a part of kind of, you know, in some way kind of helped to bring comfort to anyone in this?
You mean in the community, since the fires?
Since the fires?
Well, I mean, nothing's built yet. We're hopefully just about to start construction on the first house that is replacing one that burned down. Mm-hmm. But those clients did tell me, you know, in the course of, I told them, because I had dealings with a couple other people who had lost their homes, and it was so emotional. You know, people would cry during meetings, and it's totally understandable. They lost everything. They're just, you know, wearing the clothes on their back.
Sure.
But these people really impressed me because they were so positive. And I told them that. I said, you know, I think your attitude is fantastic because, of course, it's terrible that your house burned down, but there's nothing that you can do about that now. And you've been so positive about moving forward. And they told me that they get such comfort in, they said that the best part of their day was having these conversations because it was leading to having a home again and a home that's better than the one they had before.
Right. There's some hope there.
Exactly. Yeah. And just knowing how to move, you know, what direction to go in afterwards. You've got to deal with insurance and temporary place to live and, you know, new school for your kids possibly.
Yeah.
And all that. It's got to be overwhelming. Oh, I mean, I can only imagine.
Yeah. Without doubt. You know, we'll circle back around in another probably year, I think, with this series and kind of catch up on some of these projects, kind of see where they
That'll be interesting because, you know,
nobody knows right now, you know, and it's like we've got all these designs. We got case study 2.0, you know, there's
great idea.
40 or 50 architects there and a bunch of different, some of them have done more than one design for the project and, you know, it's great, but there's no holes in the ground yet, you know, right? You know, like no one's built anything yet. So there's still quite a lot of uncertainty, as it were. And until we kind of get through some of those steps and, you know, start to break ground on things and, you know, and get these homes going again, it's anyone's guess as to, you know, what we'll run into next. So, a little bit of a long question, but, you know, LA is, you know, kind of often seen as a city of, you know, sprawl, private enclaves, stuff like that. But architecture here can also really create, you know, some kind of intimate neighborhoods and public spaces. How do you approach placemaking in a city like LA?
You know, as someone who's designing individual homes, there's only so much control I have over the city as a whole. But I do think that respecting the fabric of a neighborhood and building a house that is appropriate to that fabric really does helps make a place. I grew up in Los Angeles, and I did not like it when I was growing up. I grew up in Studio City in the Valley, and it was very suburban. You couldn't walk anywhere. The only neighborhood that had like a real neighborhood identity that I was aware of was Westwood, because we would go there for movies. And it was a place you could walk. LA now is a very different place. I think it's changed in a very positive way. There are, you know, there's Highland Park that we were talking about earlier, Silver Lake, Echo Park, you know, Carthay. There's neighborhoods all over town that identify as neighborhoods. And I think that's really important for people to feel attached to something more local and specific than just, you know, a city of 10 million people. So I think LA has been really good in that way. When I went to Berkeley, I fell in love with the Bay Area and didn't think I ever wanted to come back to LA because, I mean, you look at the Bay Area and it's just like, it's beautiful right out the window.
You land
at LAX and you know, drive, you know, through half an hour, 40 minutes of just sprawl, you know, just endless flat sprawl. But LA has an amazing diversity and energy about it that, and a kind of a forward-looking that makes me really love this city. I love it much more than I did when I was growing up here. And I think respecting the architecture, our architectural past, even though if you're, you know, European, you think it's funny that we kind of idolize something from the 20s, but that's our history. And it is something that needs to be respected. And so I would say building sensitively to those things would be my way of contributing to LA. LA also has a very strong tradition of being a laboratory for the future. Again, you mentioned the case, the new case study program. The original case study program was an incredible thing. It's just some of the best residential architecture there has ever been.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was partly in response to a situation not dissimilar to what we are going to have in the Palisades and Altadena, because you had all these, after World War II, all these returning GIs decided, wow, the weather's great here, I want to move here. You couldn't get a contractor. You could buy a lot, but you couldn't find anybody to design something for it because so many people were, right. You know, wanted the same thing. So LA kind of leads the nation in a lot of these things, as does California with our rules for sustainability, for fire resistance, for encouraging, you know, more housing. So it's exciting to see, you know, what we come up with.
Yeah. Now I also love the Bay Area. And your comment about it just being beautiful right out the window. You know, LA has its thing. They're just very different places.
Yeah.
They're very different places, and they can both be awesome, and they are.
In my 60s dorm at Berkeley, you know, I had a spectacular view of the Bay Bridge
in
San Francisco.
No, Berkeley is an amazing place too, without doubt.
What appealed to me about LA was that it was on its way up. I felt like the Bay Area was already kind of there. Actually, when I was in school, San Francisco was pretty dead. The whole tech boom hadn't happened yet. And it felt almost like a city that was kind of resting on its laurels a little bit and maybe didn't have much upside left. A lot did change, but LA has definitely very visibly improved.
Oh yeah. So talk a little bit about civic design oversight and your participation in civic design oversight. How has that influenced your perspective as an architect?
So by civic design oversight, do you mean a design review board?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
I, by the way, am not on that board anymore. I was for a very long time. But I would say that what we really focused on in that was Council District 13, which included Hollywood Boulevard, Silver Lake, and Hollywood Boulevard really could have gone one way or the other at that time. When I started on that review board, there had been no investment in Hollywood in a long time. It was, you know, used needles on the sidewalk and, you know, really gritty. Tourists would go and see the footprints and get the hell out as fast as they could. And it's changed a lot. So our focus was generally on large projects and how they could either enhance or, you know, hopefully not detract from that sense of place. Mm. We were never looking at houses. We were never looking at residential work. So I was on that board, but my own work wasn't really relating to it because I do primarily residential work. But again, as we were talking about before, I think just respecting the fabric of a neighborhood with a house is also important. Maybe not as, you know, slam dunk obvious as a giant complex or a mall or something and the impact that will have, but it is still important.
Sure.
So
yeah,
I think that's the impact that I felt from that.
That's very cool. So kind of looking ahead, you know, what do you envision for the future of Los Angeles generally?
Well, I think we're going to be a laboratory once again for a lot of things. I mean, climate change is not stopping. We're going to have more intense and frequent fires. Traffic is a real, you know, is going to get worse before it gets better. I think rapid transit is going to become more and more important here. And that'll change where people live and how people deal with the city. You already see in this, you know, younger generation, they don't have that drive to drive that we had. I mean, I had my learner's permit the day I was old enough.
Yeah.
Kids aren't like that so much anymore. So I think there could be sort of a shifting of that aspect of living in the city. I think another thing that might happen is there could be more communal living in some form because housing is so expensive. It could be, I live in a neighborhood in Highland Park that was built in the 60s and there's 6 or 8 floor plans that repeat, but it does not feel like a tract development. Unless you were told that, you might not even notice that that's the case because each house looks different and they're sort of scattered around, but there is an economy of scale to that probably made that construction less expensive. Eichler homes were, you know, built with that kind of principle. You know, it's like tract homes, but with really good design, which mm-hmm. takes the sting out.
Sure.
I think manufactured housing and prefab, all those things are ultimately going to have a much larger share of what gets built here than they do now. And I think we'll probably lead the nation in those things as we have traditionally, both Los Angeles and California as a whole.
Sure. Yeah, I sure hope so.
Yeah.
You know, I like living in a state that's seen as a leader, and in a city, of course, that's seen as, you know, the first, you know, to pull off neat and amazing things. So yeah, you mentioned, you know, pressure like climate change, of course, more intense summer, more intense, you know, fires and stuff like that. Affordability obviously is, you know, is a pressure as well. Evolving lifestyles. Where do you think architects need to lead the way?
Well, I guess it depends what kind of practice you're in. If you're in a large firm that builds larger projects, then those things will have a greater impact. If you're someone like me and doing mostly, you know, residential work, it's a large impact on the people who live there, maybe less of one on the city as a whole, but those are still important contributions. And I think when people are introduced to good design and appreciate it, that has kind of a multiplying effect. And you know, I think I mentioned before, I'm a docent at the Gamble House. Mm-hmm. People who come on those tours are really moved by the design of that house. It shows that architecture really does have an impact on the way we live, how we feel about the way we live, et cetera. So even if you're someone like me designing houses, I think that does make a difference as well.
So, shifting gears a little bit, like as far as trends and changes, mm-hmm. go, are there any, you know, specific trends or changes that you would like to see, in, you know, either how we build or rebuild, in, you know, just communities around LA over the next, you know, decade or so?
I mean, as we already touched on, you know, obviously fire safety is super important. Sustainability is super important. There are things, fortunately, a lot of those things are already baked into the code.
I mean,
I remember for years I wanted to recapture rainwater to use on a site, and LA would not let you do it. You couldn't have permeable driveways. You couldn't recycle gray water. For a while, they were requiring it. They tossed out some of those requirements in April. But so a lot of those things are mandated. I also would love to see houses get smaller. I think they got way too big for a while, just bigger than they need to be. Not just in terms of like the, you know, the resources that it takes for that, But even just the quality of life, I think giant houses are harder to occupy happily. I was talking with one of the contractors that I work with, and he said, I think a 2,500 square foot house is perfect because you'll run into your kids. You know, if the house is much bigger than that, you might not see them at all.
Right.
You know, it's like better for families. It's better for, you know, the planet, better for the city. So that's a trend I'd like to see. And I think it's already starting to happen. I think people are aiming for less grand houses. Yeah, those are the main things. And then I think also just there are houses that really feel like they're turning their back on the neighborhood. You know, as high fences and hedges and walls that they can get away with. And I understand that if you're on a busy street, you know, you kind of need to do that.
Right.
But, you know, a house should feel like it embraces the neighborhood. My the office that I built for myself is right on the front with a big window. So I'm like looking right on the street. And I really like that. I feel connected to the street because of that, rather than being hidden away on the other side.
Right. Yeah, no, and that way you're even more a part of the community.
Yeah.
Right? You know, folks walk by and I know you're not sitting at a draftsman, you know, at a table, right, with a pencil necessarily and a slide rule, but you know, you're there, you're working, and people are walking by, and you know, they see you when they're working, and you know, you're all part of the same community, yeah. You know, as opposed to being kind of tucked back away in a.
It used to be that houses, the social life happened on the front of the house. That's where the porch was.
That's right.
The backyard was almost an afterthought. It's where you burned your leaves and dried your laundry.
Right.
And now everybody has shifted the focus to the rear at the expense of the front quite often.
No, you're absolutely right. Yeah, wasn't that post-war? Like in the late 40s that shift started, or was it later than that?
I wouldn't be surprised if it happened when, and maybe that is right when cars really became dominant.
Yeah.
Because then people aren't walking as much. They're not on the street. That's when, you know, you're sitting on your porch and you wave to your neighbors because they're walking by. Now they pull into their garage and the automatic garage door shuts and, you know, you don't see them again until they
emerge again. Yeah, no doubt. Well, kind of wrapping up, you know, what advice would you give to, you know, young architects and, you know, newbies into the, you know, design build community?
Trying to think of something that doesn't sound super corny, but I think you don't go into architecture without having a passion for it. It's not like, you know, something you go into for the money. So hopefully it's something you really care about. And I think it's really important to keep that level of care, like keep it mattering to you, and stay true to whatever your vision is of what architecture should be. There will be, hurdles to jump. Probably in any profession, but definitely in architecture. And you just got to stay with it and stay true to yourself.
Yeah. Rock on.
Semi-corny, but I think it's true.
No, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, literally everyone that we've interviewed that's an architect all have a passion for architecture, period. Well, Kevin Orrick, thank you very much again for coming in. It's very good to speak with you. I very much appreciate your take on things, and appreciate you being on the show.
All right. Well, thank you for having me.
All right.